Welcome to the Low Post Podcast, where the regular season is over and traditions must be honored. And I believe for the fourth straight year, the great David Thorpe of True Hoop now, the revitalized True Hoop, and I are going to do our 8x8 podcast, 8 minutes, and that is a loose timetable, on each of the 8 first-round series, although we may not get to 8 on Clippers-Warriors. Sorry, Clippers. Coach, how are you doing?
I am great. I appreciate you having me on. And just very quickly, as I once emailed you, as much as I absolutely love listening to your pod every week, minimum once a week, my favorite parts of every one is when you spend a few seconds to talk about your daughter and your family. It always reminds me of what it was like when I had young kids. I don't anymore, as you and I were just talking off air. And so please don't ever stop doing that, because for those of us that are dads of older kids, we like remembering what it was like when they were young and the kids really loved us.
Hey, do you like remembering when it took 12 minutes for your 4-year-old to brush her teeth in like 4 different tantrums? Because that's what I lived through this morning. Is that a fond one for you?
Well, it's different with twins because we just left it to themselves. I think as long as they were walking, we're like, you guys figure it out. Mom and I need a break.
Okay, so we're going to do something radical for the NBA in 2019 on this podcast. We're going to talk about basketball. We're not going to talk about how two teams, including the Grizzlies, 5 seconds ago fired their coaches today and some other things. We're not going to talk about Magic Johnson's 4-hour farewell press conference or anything like that. We're going to talk about basketball. We're going to put 8 minutes on the clock for each of these first-round series, and I have arbitrarily put them in order of my personal interest level. So it's a total dictatorship. You have no say in this. No one else has any say in this. We're going in the order that I want, from most interesting to Clippers Grizzlies. Are you ready, Coach?
Yes, sir.
We are going to put 8 minutes on the clock for 4-5 in the West, thanks to a series of tanktastic events from the Denver Nuggets, the Houston Rockets, and the Utah Jazz, a rematch of last season's conference semifinals, won 4-1 by Houston. Ricky Rubio missed that entire series. They split the season series this year 2-2. There were missed games littering some of those. This is counterintuitive, because the most interesting part of any Houston game is usually how in the hell are they going to guard James Harden? And the answer for Utah has been actually mostly Ricky Rubio, whose health is in question, and dropping Gobert back at the rim like most of these teams do. I'm actually more interested on the other side of the ball. Utah's offense, 14th in the league, although the numbers are much better than that when they play their Jay Crowder at the 4 lineup versus the Favors Gobert lineup. But we remember last season against a different, both stylistically and qualitatively, Rockets defense that switched all the time. The Jazz could not score. The Jazz could not score against them in the regular season. And so to me, this is a very competitive series. The numbers would say these are two of the best 3 or 4 teams in the league, if not the 2 best periods since about February 1st. To me, this series gets interesting if Utah can score on Houston. And that sounds weird, because Houston's defense has been bad all year. But A, I think they have another gear. And B, we have some evidence that the way they play, although they don't switch as much as they used to, is a problem for a Utah team that doesn't have a post-up guy, dump it down, put somebody in the basket, and really only has Mitchell as a one-on-one guy. So, Coach, take that end of the floor. What are you looking for from Utah to kind of loosen up the works a little bit?
Well, first of all, you stole my line. First thing I have is that they are the 2 best teams since February 1st. If you almost any metric you look at when you combine offense and defense. So, and for Utah, they've been shooting it great. I don't know that anyone would think of Utah as a great shooting team, but since February 1st, they've been shooting it great. And so my second note was, Donovan Mitchell as a passer, because I do think they're going to switch a lot on ball screens with him. And Houston is not crazy tall. In fact, we know them as a team that likes to play small with P.J. Tucker as a 4, and even maybe sometimes I think they might throw him out some as a 5 in this series. But there's a lot of long-rangey guys that they have that seem to bother Mitchell at the rim, which is a very important thing for him, to be able to get to the rim and finish. He's not the best finisher. And so, but what I do think is important is whether or not he's going to take on that role of being a shot creator for people, because if he can do that, because they will bring a crowd to him when he drives, and if he's willing just to make the easy play, remember, he's still a very young player. Yeah, he got experience last year, but if he's willing to be that guy, in a sense, what Rubio often does, because he doesn't want to shoot the ball, and they're shooting it the way they're shooting it in the past, that team can ring up some numbers. And then it gets down to, and you've written about this and I've tweeted about this, now you go to the other end because Harden is unguardable and he's going to get any shot he wants. And if he's making those shots, the pressure is on to continue to make them if Utah can hit theirs, which is what it gets down to, you know, kind of a shot-making series, which isn't always the case, but it is in this one, I think.
Yeah, you know, when you talk about Mitchell and his making a simple play, I mean, the most obvious way to attack – now, Houston doesn't switch as much as they used to because they got nervous about 20 games into the season of about taking their big guys away from the rim and just hemorrhaging offensive rebounds, and they wanted to protect Chris Paul and Eric Gordon a little bit from just getting obliterated by big guys down low. So we'll see if they amp up the switching. But I think two areas for Utah to sort of scrounge some points. If their half-court offense is a little gummy, number one, offensive rebounding. They're a good offensive rebounding team, not a great one, and Houston is awful on the boards. And number two, and this is really out of Utah's wheelhouse, I think they need to run a little bit. I think they need to selectively run, kind of how, you know, like when Cleveland beat the Warriors, everyone's like, Cleveland, it would be suicidal for them to run. It's not their style, and they're playing the Warriors. I kind of think with the way, like when James Harden misses at the rim, there are four guys below the foul line. And if they get that rebound, I think Utah, which is a so-so offensive team, that's when they have to say, let's go. Let's look ahead. Let's see if we can get some easy points. It's not in our DNA. It's not the way we play, but maybe we can run into something. And I think that those are the little sort of side battles that make these series so interesting.
Well, and something else to watch for too is if you and I both agree that there really is nothing you can do with Harden. If Phoenix recently tried to double him early off the dribble and off the pass, and it was laughable. I think they hit 27 threes or whatever in the game. You can't double that guy. Plus, he also can score one on two. But what you can do is put him in a lot of pin down actions and handoff actions. He, especially pin down with Mitchell. When he's guarding Mitchell, they can run Mitchell off the ball and then pin him down, and then Harden just wants to stay on his guy. He doesn't want to pop out. And so on the switch, he's just going to stay with his guy. If it's on the inside, he doesn't want to show in the perimeter and have to guard someone, you know, 25 feet from the basket, considering how much work he has to do on offense. So if they can try to get Harden involved defensively, which is not rocket science, teams have done that in the past, but especially off the ball as much as on the ball, there's a chance, and again, it's just a chance, that he's not going to do what he's supposed to do. Teammates might get frustrated. D'Antoni might be a little miffed, especially if guys like Mitchell and Rubio, whomever, are scoring off at Crowder. You might just piss him off a little bit. You need to try to do something, because if you don't do anything to get into James Harden on one end of the floor, then the offensive end is going to kill you, because I just don't think there's anything to do with him there. It's something that Utah can hang their hat on constantly in timeouts and before games and at halftime, is let's get Harden off the ball into actions and make him do something.
Yeah, it's something that really stood out on the film of this head-to-head in the regular season, is Utah, when they got fancy, when they added wrinkles on top of wrinkles, they actually put Houston in problematic positions. So, like, instead of just running a pick and roll, have Mitchell screen for Rubio if Rubio plays, and then pop out behind another screen right away. They actually ran some split action where somebody would post up and then they would do the war what the Warriors do. Everyone just sort of runs together and comes apart. That stuff gave Houston and particularly Harden some issues. On the other end of the floor, we know what they're going to do. They're going to climb on top of James Harden's left shoulder and try to force him towards Gobert at the rim. And if you recall, I think we're going to see a lot of Royce O'Neal, because he's the sort of most natural matchup for Harden. Exum being out is maybe a slight problem, although he's so bad offensively that I don't know that it is. And if you recall, last year they were actually all right against Harden. It was Chris Paul that killed them. And I think Gobert this year has looked a little more spry coming out as far as he needs to come out to at least not make that a 15-foot layup for Chris. And so those are sort of and there are little wrinkles you can look for. Like whenever Korver's on the court, they're going to have Korver's man come screen for Harden and this and that. But I just think, you know, if they can make, like, Chris Paul just sliced them up last year, and if they can make that a little harder. But on the flip side, Harden is so much better against that kind of defense, having seen it so many times. He has a real floater now that's a real weapon for him. If he gets ahead of steam, like, I love when Nene sets a pick for him at like half court, and he can just be like, Gobert, you're now 30 feet away from me. I am coming at you, and that's a problem. It's such an interesting chess match.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you mentioned the thing. I call it just the early high screen for Harden when he gets that momentum going. He's impossible anyway, but that's really hard when the high screen, whoever it is. The Austin Rivers, if it's going to be a competitive series, and you and I both, I think, feel like it's going to be six or seven games, or it certainly could be, well, then little things really matter.
I'm not quite there yet, but I'll allow it.
I think it's going to be competitive. Obviously, how Harden finishes games will be huge, because I think the game's going to be close, and he's just better than everyone, in my opinion. But Austin Rivers, as a non-shooter, can be a problem. But if when they take Harden out of the game, I don't know that Utah's got many guys that can stay in front of him one-on-one and let him be the facilitator. He's obviously not Harden. But you can't put him in really when Harden is in the game, because now his guy is an easy helper. So how he does things, and I want to see how PJ does at the five, if they try that some. Gobert's improved enough as a roller dunker now where he might be able to overwhelm PJ, where in years past maybe he couldn't because he wasn't strong enough. But those are things that we can't just assume James is going to get 40 every game. He might, and then it's an academic. But if he doesn't, some of the Houston guys have to do well.
I believe we are out of. I shouldn't have sneered at the idea of a six or seven game series. I actually think Utah. I think this should be a decently competitive series. The Rubio thing worries me a little bit.
Yeah,
and I just think it's a matchup. It's a difficult matchup, and it's a shame that Denver's scheme to engineer this actually worked. Although it took a crazy series of events to make it work, but I will end up probably picking Houston to win this series. Okay, our time is now up on this series. All right, Coach, we are going to put 8 minutes on the clock for my number two most interesting first round series. Staying out west, the Portland Trail Blazers, the improbable third seed, at least improbable considering how their season ended last year, against the Oklahoma City Thunder, a matchup that I don't think Portland wanted when they decided to rest their whole team on the last day of the regular season. But they got, and this was a 4-0 sweep for the Thunder in the regular season, although one of the games went to overtime, another was a two-point game. This was a close-ish sweep. Paul George averaged 38 points per game against Portland in those four games and absolutely lit them up from three. Steven Adams was just destroying people with screens, and PG was walking in to easy threes. And when he wasn't doing that, he was going right at Yusuf Nurkic. And that is where I want to start, which is, in your opinion, is the downgrade from Nurkic to Kanter in this series against Oklahoma City's blitzing, pressuring defense, is it more painful for Portland on their offensive end or on defense?
Oh, my God. That's a great question. Oh, I would almost call it a tie. Kanter is a very, very bad defensive player. It should be a little bit mitigated offensively because they don't have to factor him in as much. Nurkic was becoming actually a good offensive player as a passer and as a terrific screener and passer, and so Kanter is neither of those things, although he can be a decent screener if he wants to be. I would probably lean more defensively because you can't really hide him because Oklahoma City won't let them hide him. And on the flip side, I would say, and you've said this on your podcast before, OKC without Paul George is just, whatever you call him, a trash fire.
Some sort of collection of trash. I don't know what whether it's on fire or not. I don't know.
Well, sometimes it's on fire. And that really, to me, is the most interesting part of the series is I think we know Oklahoma City is significantly better, especially the way they played the last 2 weeks, which they needed it because they were kind of dying. If they can survive when he's out and just almost tread water, they're going to be fine. But how do they do that? And so one thing I think they can do is get him out early. When Schroeder comes in for him, that lineup is very, very good for OKC. So if they can get George out early and then come back in with some reserves, then they'll probably end up being fine. But I sometimes question how both Donovan and Scotty Brooks back before him used to do the rotations. If they sit him out for a while and when Portland brings some of their starters back in and George is still out, that can be a problem for me. And then we'll see what Portland does. I think they've got to totally change up how they defend, more zone, just let their shooters shoot threes. They've got to play as severe underdogs and not think they can just match up, you know, 5-on-5 all the time and without Nurkic.
Yeah, there's a lot of little poetic things in this series. It's the can't play Cantor revenge series from when Billy Donovan was caught saying that on television two seasons ago. It's two coaches who I think are under pressure to win this series, given what has happened in the playoffs the last couple of years. And it is a year removed from a trapping blitzing defense completely reducing Damian Lillard to a quaking, nervous turnover machine. And he is going to face that kind of defense again. That's how the Thunder play. Even Steven Adams will come out and hit you in the face 30 feet from the rim. And that's why I almost think they might miss Nurkic more on offense in this series, even though Cantor is one of the worst defensive players in the league and Nurkic is one of the best. Nurkic's defense is underrated. He became a good release valve for them. He could catch the ball 20 feet from the rim and make plays. Cantor can do that, but not quite as well and not quite as willingly. That said, Dame, I think, has gotten better at handling that kind of pressure. He's just craftier. He's smarter. He'll string it out to the side. He'll split traps. He'll do all sorts of different things. I think he's a little better at it, but that's an interesting one. And I just wonder sort of if Cantor struggles, and we know he's going to struggle on defense, although Adams kind of is the kind of matchup he can hang in. There's no one's going to stretch him out. Zach Collins, it's one of those things where Zach Collins is sort of a year away, I think, from becoming a stretch five that could really change this series, but I'm interested to see him try. And I think Myers Leonard could have a little role in this series. Like, if the traps are really starting to bother CJ, who's coming off an injury, you know, maybe throw him out there and see if he can make some threes. But, the Nurkic-Cantor thing looms large on both ends of the floor.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the offensive stuff. That's what really, and I wrote about this on Trouba a couple weeks ago. Nurkic as a passer was really kind of a revelation for them when you look forwards. You didn't really have to play so much with Dame and CJ with the ball, which is fine, having him with the ball. But when they can also score without the ball, it's just much harder to guard. And I wrote in my notes, no Nurkic means more off the dribble, which means it's easier to spot. So in other words, when they're playing without the ball and Nurkic had the ball, KC doesn't necessarily know where the pain's going to come from. But when Lillard or CJ have the ball now, they kind of know where they can bring the crowd to, because Cantor just can't play the same way. And I do think Collins is something they're going to have to go to. The problem is he's going to be eaten alive by Steven Adams. That is a large, strong man. And Zach isn't that, whereas Cantor is. And we talked about that. You said that. So the advantage is a little bit mitigated with Cantor in. But on the other hand, there's a lot of things he doesn't do well. Let's see how OKC. I think Portland's going to play. I mean, you make a point about Stotts needing to win the game. I get it. But when you lose a player as important as Nurkic, you would think they would say, okay, third seed again. You know, his job. Listen, if he does lose his job, he'll get hired the next day.
Absolutely. Terry's a good coach. Right? There's no question about that.
Yeah, what he's done is right. But I'd like to see Stotts really play with some stuff and just try some crazy things. And on the other hand, let's just see how good we want to see how OKC plays going forward. Are they the team that for a long time was putting Paul George in at least the conversation for MVP because they were such an upstart team? Or are they the team that kind of died along the way until the very end? How Russ does in terms of emotional IQ, if he stays under control and just controls his team, not just for his own emotions, for them as a group, that they should be fine in six games. But if he doesn't, I think Portland, they have the talent mostly because of Lillard, who's actually probably underrated. He's one of the best players in the world. And I know that you know that because I've heard you talk about him. Then Portland can be dangerous.
Yeah, I think Russ, but look, they've won every game and he's played pretty well in these games, but he can get carried away with give me the ball on the block and let me throw up these bank shots from 14 feet. And I think Portland would be excited if he got caught up in a sort of one-on-one, let me rock the baby and do my taunting down here. Turnovers are going to be something to watch. This is the number one turnover-forcing defense in the league in Oklahoma City against a team that's pretty good at taking care of the ball. Same with rebounds. Oklahoma City is a great offensive rebounding team. Portland's a good defensive rebounding team. And Portland, you know, they know they have all sorts of tricks to deal with that kind of pressure defense. They'll screen the screener, so they'll hit Adams with a pick on the way up and sort of give Dame some momentum. They'll do that kind of stuff. But, you know, Kanter's just not as good at it as Nurkic. And, you know, Portland's, the thing that Portland has to overcome in every series is, you know, the best playoff teams have two big wing defenders that when they face Oklahoma City, they say, okay, one's on Russ and one's on PG, and the little guy, you go hide on Ferguson over here. And right. The Blazers just don't have that. They don't have that luxury. Now, they can play around with the matchups a little bit and see what they can do, but it's going to be impossible for them, unless they really get gimmicky, to have a lot of minutes where Russ is going to have Lillard or CJ on them, and they're going to have to live with that. And I think they will, as long as they can do a good job on George, which they did not do. And that was primarily Harkless, some Aminu. We'll see who that matchup is.
And George is playing great too. And I don't know that he's not playing to the level that he was during that time. Of course, we know the playoffs, things can change a little bit. Let's just hope for one thing, at least for me anyway. I want to see Lillard shoot 15 to 17, 18 threes a game. CJ about 12, 13. Just if they're going to lose, go down with those guys, just jacking it.
Yeah, and the interesting thing with Portland that I'm always fun to watch with them is sort of who gets the Harkless minutes. Like, they'll start Harkless and Aminu, and it's boring to say, but a lot of Portland's success will come down to, do those guys make open threes? Because if they do, Portland will win games, and if they don't, Portland will lose. But they'll downsize from that, and they'll play Dame, CJ, and Hood together. I don't know that they'll dare to play those two with Curry. We'll see. But they can kind of get funky with littler lineups and then put one of those little guys on Grant and keep Aminu on George and play with the matchups that way. And they got some interesting stuff they can do. This is still, without Nurkic, a talented team. If CJ's healthy, it's a talented team. It's a polished team. And, you know, unless they kind of quake like they did last year against a trapping defense, they're not going to beat themselves. And Oklahoma City, I mean, I haven't checked the numbers in the last week since about a week ago when half the teams in the league stopped trying, but this was the 29th offense in the league for like 2 months. So I don't know that we can look at their success against Portland in the regular season where they blitzed, they just obliterated them and on offense and say, well, there's this sort of endemic problem here and Oklahoma City's going to keep scoring at that route. At that rate. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see, but where this one is, I haven't thought enough about this one to pick yet. I'm leaning towards the Thunder just because of the Nurkic thing, but I'm very interested to see how Portland comes out, because this is a team that from day one and even like day negative 80, like after they lost that series to New Orleans, the way they have responded and the pride that they have and the sort of cultural stability they have has really impressed me. And I think they are really hungry to come out even without Nurkic and say, what happened, and just show, even if it's they lose in seven or something, what happened last year is not who we are as a team. And Damian Lillard in particular, what happened to me last year is not who I am as a player. And I'm just interested to see, like you said, you want to see Terry Stotts sort of get crazy and do stuff. I'm just interested to see their mentality. I'm just interested to see how they come out. And I think they're going to come out mentally pretty tough.
We saw Virginia did in college after losing in the first round last year. You've referenced Steph Curry as an amazing leader behind the scenes. Damian might even rank higher. If anyone ranks higher in the league at culture building, as also an elite superstar, Damian is that guy. So, yeah, I think it's going to be, like I said, I think it's going to be a 6 or 7 game series because of Lillard's leadership. He's also maybe the smartest point guard we have in the game right now. He's not just super talented. He's like a computer chip on the court, just figuring stuff out all the time. So he'll put them in a good position a lot.
Okay, we are out of time, and we are going to move on. Stop the clock. All right, let's put 8 minutes on the clock for my arbitrarily selected third most interesting first-round playoff series, another Western Conference series. The Denver Nuggets, the 2 seed, against the San Antonio Spurs, the 7 seed. And the primary reason I'm interested in this is the rampant skepticism that Denver is not real, is going to be vulnerable in this series. No matter who they would play, I think that there would have been sort of a perception of Denver as a paper tiger. I don't agree with that. I think they should win this series. I think this is a very good matchup for them. But it's the first time. It's the first time for most of these players. It's the first time for Nikola Jokic as the focus of a postseason defense game plan. And we have seen him commit lots of frustration fouls, get thrown out of games, get mentally taken out of games. I don't think it's going to be a problem. I think he is smart enough and in control of himself enough to realize, okay, this is the real season. But you just never know. However, I think this is a good matchup for Denver. Jokic destroyed San Antonio, although they split the series 2-2. Denver was missing tons of players in every game. Let me start here, Coach. They played four times. Jakob Poeltl started two, I believe the last two, and they started small with LaMarcus at center in the first two. This one is one you could kind of go either way for me. The Poeltl-Aldridge 4-5 combo was very bad in the regular season overall. It was like minus 10 points per 100 possessions or minus 8 points for 100 possessions overall. It was good against Denver in a limited sample size. You can see the appeal of it for Pop here because Denver with Millsap, well, Denver is essentially a big team all the time. They'll maybe dabble here and there with Torrey Craig at the four, but it's been Jokic, Millsap, Plumlee taking 90 of the 96 big man minutes for a while now. So you think, okay, we can play what should be our best defensive lineup against that team. However, Poeltl, who I like, makes Jokic's life pretty easy, I think, defensively. And LaMarcus at the five is a different kind of challenge for him, and Rudy Gay at the four is a different kind of challenge for any team, and you have your offensive firepower that way. What do you think the Spurs will do or should do approaching Denver in this series?
I think they should do a bit of a hybrid of what they did in the Ray Allen Miami Heat series, where Ray Allen hit that big three in game six, where they kind of didn't guard anybody for about five games. And I'm not even sure they guarded them in six and seven, but LeBron started shooting a lot of threes. In fact, I think it took 10 or 11 in game seven. You cannot guard Jokic on the perimeter. First of all, I believe he's made three of his last 25, so you probably shouldn't guard him out there until he starts making more. But he destroys you. He's almost like Steve Nash that way, except he can't shoot the way Nash could. The team sometimes used to play Nash to shoot because he didn't want to shoot. Jokic just dissects defenses with his passing. And then when Poeltl makes a mistake, I just think he lacks some discipline. He's inexperienced or not thinking fast enough. There were times I saw on tape where he was closing out Jokic and just leaving the passing lane that he would just use to throw it to a guy for a lob or a backdoor, you know, bounce pass for a bucket or a dunk.
This is interesting what you're saying to me, because you were the first one years and years ago to say teams need to guard Rondo instead of sitting 15 feet away from him, because that way he can see everything and has clear angles. But you think the opposite for Jokic. You think they should sit 15 feet off of him and just dare him to shoot?
Absolutely right. That's what you've got to do. And so actually the way to do it is what I call a slow contest. So if he was a brilliant shooter, you would have to do a hot contest. You'd have to race out, hands up, butt down. Not butt that far down, because he's probably not too much of a threat of a drive. Although he's more mobile than you think. He's such a brilliant, crafty player. Really a genius. I imagine Sabonis probably was like this, the father, when he was his age. Just such a brilliant basketball player. But you got to slow contest. So you initially, on the catch, you've got to play the pass. And then once your teammate has defended the cutter and with your help, then you start going out there. You can't just not guard him at all, because he will dissect you at some point. That's super important right there, that they do that, because he's going to get his points no matter what, on the glass, just off the dribble and of course in the low post. But if you let him also rack up 9, 10, 11 assists, which they did not do, they did a pretty good job during the season, but they didn't really focus on this. And Poeltl especially was, I thought, guilty of making some mental mistakes. But if they do that, I think they can slow Denver's offense down, which has not been playing well for a while. And I know you said that you thought they should handle the series. I'm not so sure. And I know you're not predicting a definite win. Neither am I. I don't know what's going to happen. I think it's going to be very competitive because Denver's not been playing well lately. And the Spurs have. And I also think that Derek White, who I've never seen miss a shot, I know he misses plenty, but I just never see it. what he does defensively can bother Jamal Murray a good amount. And Denver needs Murray to play well, I think, because of what I think Spurs are going to do with Jokic.
The Murray-Harris-Barton group has not sort of clicked together really at all this season, and Harris and Barton have missed a ton of time. That's the primary reason. But they are the three of them are so active, cutting and moving without the ball, and I just don't trust anyone on the Spurs defense, other than Derek White, of their perimeter defenders to hang with that. And that's one thing that worries me for San Antonio. Another thing that worries me for San Antonio is Denver is 30th in the amount of corner threes they give up, i.e. the most, and like 25th in the amount of shots at the rim they give up. The Spurs are 30th in percentage of shots at the rim and 29th in percentage of their shots that are corner threes. So Denver has these very clear defensive weak spots. Now, whether they're weak spots is somewhat of a semantic argument. I mean, the way they play, the aggressive style they play, if you can pass around their rotations and stuff, I think you can pass yourself into those kind of good looks from those spots. Denver would argue that they are giving up pressured corner threes and pressured shots at the rim. Whatever the case may be, a really good offensive team is going to hurt them in those spots. And the Spurs just are not designed to take shots from there. Now, maybe they will emphasize that, knowing these numbers, as they surely do. But I think that's another thing that kind of bodes well for Denver. And I just, even when they put LaMarcus at the five, I just don't see anything that stresses me out about defensively for Denver. I don't see anything where I'm like, ooh, that's going to be the DeRozan-Aldridge pick and roll, like they're just going to eat Jokic for lunch. Like, I think Jokic can hang fine no matter how the Spurs play. And on the other end, he averaged 17-9-9 on 70% shooting and just ate them alive in the post. They scored 1.3 points per possession on when Jokic posted up. The Spurs are similar teams in that they both play slowly. They're not going to overwhelm you athletically. And I think that kind of it just feels like a good series for Denver to me.
Well, I agree with every point you made. I would only add one thing, though. The Spurs are an elite shooting team, especially lately. The Nuggets are going to give up something. They don't want to give up threes, but you're not going to be able to just take away San Antonio's very, very good mid-range game, especially short mid-range. And because by doing so, it means they're going to have to occupy Jokic that much more inside, and they just got to be careful with him. He's too valuable offensively to he can't play like Rudy Gobert on defense. First of all, he can't physically do that, but no. To ask him to do too much is a mistake as well, because he basically their point guard on offense for more or less. And so I think San Antonio is a great shooting team. I think I like how you put it. I would just argue that any team that shoots it as well as the Spurs are capable of shooting it, they make any offense look better. It's kind of like a secret. I don't think the NBA necessarily talks about it now. That's why it's a secret. Is great shooting mitigates every problem you have, and they are capable of really shooting it well. On the other hand, I think that what you talked about is Jokic inside, and I think that's what the Spurs are going to say. Like again, I compare him to Steve Nash. You remember when Dallas played Phoenix one time and basically just did not let Nash be a passer, and he averaged like 30-something in the series at a couple of 40-some-odd point games. And I don't remember who won the series and went 6 or 7 games. But that's kind of how I think the Spurs are going to play Jokic. They're going to play him to score, and he might put up some big numbers, but other guys won't. And then later in the game, if they've not been doing much all game long, you can extend out a little bit more and then double in a little bit, because those guys haven't really – shooting is part of a rhythm thing and a confidence thing. And that's where I also think the seeding matters, Zach, is how – we talk about mindset in a lot of these series. If Denver takes the approach of, well, we're heavily favored 2 seed, and I think they are going to feel that, well, then those shots become even more – you know, you've been in those arenas. There is a palpable feeling – in these postseason games that the Spurs guys are pretty young. A lot of them haven't experienced it, but plenty of them have. Denver's a little bit different. They're going to have to make some big shots, and if they've not been shooting them for 3 quarters, and all of a sudden they're going to have to in the fourth, and I think that's what Pop's mode is going to be early on anyway in game 1 or 2, is let's force Jokic to be a scorer early, and then let's kind of take him away late and see how those guys react. I'm not convinced they're not going to react great. And San Antonio goes home 1-1, and then I think it's a great series.
Yeah, I think it's a game 1, game 2 series. I think the Spurs need to steal one of the first two in Denver and shake their confidence a little bit. And I think Denver's crowd is going to come out absolutely amped. First playoff game since Iguodala left there. And if Denver can sort of feed off that and come out and say, hey, we are a legit 54-55, whatever they finished that win team. Let's go prove it. We're not nervous. We're going to play free and easy. We like this matchup. You know, then I think the series will turn in a friendly way for them. And the last thing is that, you know, I love LaMarcus Aldridge. I considered him for my All-NBA team. I didn't put him on. I think he's one of the great floor raisers in the NBA. Just competes on both ends, just does his job. I get a little nervous for the Spurs when I look at a matchup and I see 48 minutes of really good post defenders to throw at him. And that's what the Nuggets have. If they can play every possession with, now there'll be switches and mismatches and they'll run cross screens and all that junk for him. But if it's 48 minutes of, and we've seen it against Golden State, now none of these guys is Draymond Green, but when he's got three post defenders who can all guard him one-on-one, it can be tough sledding for him. And I think this matchup is going to be tough sledding for him.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong with that. When Jokic, I kind of look at it the other way too. When Jokic goes out and Denver's not nearly as good, that's when San Antonio's got to really make some hay. It's got to be a decision before the game, as hey, let's be smart about how we're subbing so that when they rest Jokic, we've got a really strong group. Whatever they think their numbers tell them, because they're going to have to make some serious hay when he's out of the game.
That's it. Let's pause and move on to my fourth most interesting series of the first round. Let's put 8 minutes on the clock for my fourth most interesting series. Finally, we are moving to the Eastern Conference, and we are moving to my NBA home away from home, the Toronto Raptors, the number two seed in the East against, finally back in the playoffs for the first time since Dwight Howard and his favorite candies left Orlando. The Orlando Magic, who had a very nice season and a very nice run toward the end, and actually split the season series with the Raptors, blew out Toronto twice, outscored them substantially over the four games that they played. Now, Kyle Lowry missed one of the losses, and Kawhi Leonard missed another of the losses. So let's just look past that. See, this is interesting primarily because Toronto has had this season where Lowry's in, Leonard's out. Leonard's in, Lowry's out. Marc Gasol comes in, who are we starting, blah, blah, blah. They seem to have settled on Marc Gasol as their starting center. I think Gasol Vucevic is an interesting matchup for they're similar players, a little different, but similar and both very good. And Toronto feels primed to me to come out and feel comfortable saying, this is who we are. We know who we are as a team. We're confident. We're home. I'm interested to see how they come out. But Orlando's defense has been top three in the league for 3-4 months now. That's a real thing. They have Aaron Gordon, who can at least physically match up with Kawhi Leonard. Kawhi Leonard has shot 42% against the Magic this year. They have Jonathan Isaac, who has been an absolute problem for my guy Pascal Siakam, shot 34% in this series. Give me one thing that gives you hope, Coach, that this is a competitive series for the Magic.
Oh, well, you already said it. Their half-court defense is terrific, and they're really the coach deserves a lot of credit. They're playing terrific basketball in terms of getting, as Papa used to always say, good to great, right? Get a good shot, work for a great shot, play away from the crowd. What I'm looking at in the series in terms of where I think Toronto can really build that margin are two things. How Kawhi does, we don't know. Aaron Gordon is this crazy athlete with size, but if Kawhi gets going, he's Kawhi Leonard and shouldn't be all that tired. He missed a lot of games this year. Toronto, I love the term you like to use when you call people sneaky, whatever. I don't know how sneaky Toronto's transition game is, but they don't play at a super fast pace, more or less average. But they really push when they can. And I think in this particular matchup, when you watch them play on tape, they're looking to fly, which they should, because you don't want to face Orlando's defense in the half court every possession. You want to push early and maybe get some cross matches because of a transition or just great shots. And Toronto's athletic, but so is Orlando. In fact, Orlando's probably more athletic. So if the Raptors can really get moving early, Gasol is a rebounder, outlet passer, is terrific, one of the better in the league at it. They've got those guys to race to the rim and race to the corner threes. Orlando doesn't go to the glass anyway, but they don't always get back great. They're young. And if Toronto can do that in the full court, they'll be good enough in the half court probably to at least always have an advantage. And then we'll see. You mentioned Jonathan Isaac shooting. That is I tweeted this, obviously, my favorite matchup of the whole postseason is Siakam versus Isaac, because they're such similar players, and I think that I really think Isaac has a chance to be MIP next year. He's really kind of coming on, but they're going to make him shoot it, Zach. When they kind of choose how they want to defend Orlando, that's going to be a choice I think they make early on. Is he's got to be the guy to make the three, And I don't know that he will. He's not a great shooter. He's okay. He's certainly capable of it. If he struggles early on, that'll be much harder for Orlando to get going. And like all these teams, they got to try to win one of these two games early on.
He finished at 32%, but his stroke got a little better to me as the season went on. And you hit one of my big issues on the head, nailed it. I'll read you some stats. Toronto, they're league average in pace, but when they're rolling, when they're getting stops, and Kyle Lowry's on the floor and Siakam's on the floor, they are looking to run every time off a miss. And here's a stat for you. Points plus per possession. This is my buddy Ben Falk at Cleaning the Glass, which is essentially how many more points you add on a transition play versus a typical half-court play. And just straight up points per play in transition, that's a different category. Toronto is number one in both. So when they run, they are incredibly effective and like lethal efficient. Orlando is number two and number two in both of those categories in transition defense, which is a hallmark of all Steve Clifford teams. They get back on defense, they make you earn it. That is a very interesting battle within a battle. And also there's going to be cross matches all over the floor, because in most of the matchups, Kawhi has guarded Isaac, but Gordon is guarding Kawhi on the other end of the floor. So they're going to be trying to find the right people if they care. So that's an interesting one. And I just think the center matchup, Gasol and Vucevic. Vucevic is going to have to hit open threes. Orlando loves that action where Fournier comes for a handoff from Vucevic on the left side of the floor, and there's no other player on that side, so it's an empty side action, and two defenders go with Fournier, and he throws it back to Vucevic. Now, Gasol is smart. He knows how to play the angles, not quite as fast as he used to be. Vuce and Fournier are going to have to make hay in those situations, and I've talked to coaches around the league who have been scouting the Magic, because nobody knew what the freaking matchups were going to be until the last day of the season. That Fournier-Vucevic two-man game on the left side, people fear it. It's a real thing. Coaches fear it, and Ibaka is almost better equipped than Gasol to handle it, but the starting lineups are what they are. Orlando's got some things they can turn to, is my only point.
Oh, no question. Yeah, I like how you put it. They're a real thing with that action, the two-man action. But they're a real team. Like, if you were betting futures, they're a team you would put some money on. They've got a future if they decide what they do with Vooch and keep him and all of that. And to me, Vooch is obviously the key. He's their best player. How they defend him. Toronto, it can be a great shooting team. They have lots of guys that can shoot well and have shot well. And Orlando knows he's not a guy that can be super active and protect at the rim, so they got to try to get him to hang back. And that means shooters can be open. Gasol's got to be willing to shoot that shot.
Has to be. Gasol's going to have to be more willing than he was. Now, he started to get more willing toward the end, but they got him in part to shoot pick-and-pop threes and shoot trail threes. And because he's a natural pleaser, he has spent his early time in Toronto looking for everybody else. And there's been a method to that. The method is they're passing more, their assist rate up, the ball is moving, everyone's happy. But in playoff time, if he has open threes in those scenarios, he's got to take them and he's got to make them.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think there's one thing I'll be looking for that we haven't talked about yet is the Raptors. I don't know if it's something they've talked about. I've never asked Masai this, but they like to have Kyle switch on to big wings like Aaron Gordon and let the other team think that that's a mismatch.
Absolutely.
It's fun to watch a lot of times. Kyle is it's like Jameer Nelson used to be the same way. It was not easy scoring on that.
Well, I think whatever Kyle weighs, I think his ass is like 40% of it. Whatever the body weight is, that's where it is.
Yeah, that's something we value as coaches. Trust me, we look at that when we're scouting. He's not an easy guy to score with down there, and it screws up Orlando's offense, which is literally what they want to do in the first place. Is if they can get you to change what you're trying to do and get this quote-unquote mismatch, the mouse in the house inside, good luck with that. That's exactly what Toronto will do. Orlando's got to be disciplined and not fall for that. And then on the other end, I think that the Raptors can attack DJ. I like DJ Augustine. I've been a fan long before he kind of resurrected his career, but he is a defensive liability that Toronto's got a lot of guys with talent to take advantage of it. But I still think it comes down to, besides the shooting thing, which it always comes down to, is how successful can Toronto be in that transition game? Because if they are, Orlando's in a lot of trouble. If they're not, there's a lot more pressure on those shooters because the Magic will guard their stuff really well. And then it gets down to the X factor, which is always, people talk about X factors being like favorite players of mine, like Jeremy Grant. I know you love Jeremy too, but really, it's the superstars. I witnessed in college one time Grant Hill carry a Duke team that was outmatched in the Final Four because he's Grant Hill, and Kawhi Leonard is Kawhi freaking Leonard. If he does his nuclear routine, Toronto's significantly better. And if he doesn't, I think it's a great series.
Yeah, the two points you just made there in my notes. Toronto's going to switch 1-4 a lot. On defense, they're equipped to do it. They like to do it. They don't care if Aaron Gordon posts up
right.
Kyle Lowry. That to me makes Vucevic even more important because that's where they won't switch. And Augustine, defensively, you will see the Magic hide him on Danny Green and put Fournier on Lowry so that they can switch any Lowry-Kawhi two-man game with Fournier and Gordon. And anytime there's a cross match, that makes transition that much more fraught, and just who can exploit that. So I think this has a chance to be, if not a super competitive series, although I think it could be competitive, a fun one. But we will now move on to series number 5, and we will stay in the East for the Indiana Pacers and the Boston Celtics. Okay, the 4-5 series in the East, the only one, remarkably, that was set in stone before the final night of the regular season. Indiana, which is now a 500-ish team since Oladipo's injury after starting off very well, wore down. They had a hellish road schedule toward the end and have been struggling. And I think they actually may be a little fatigued after having everyone sort of have to carry a little bit more of a load against Boston, who has been good luck figuring them out, but they've been surging toward the end of the season. The Baines-Al Horford double big lineup has been very effective, and I think this is a good series for it against an Indiana team that plays two traditional bigs almost all the time. My big question, the big picture question, there's always one end of the floor that I think is the swing end, and to me, why I think this series is such a bad matchup for the Pacers is I just don't know how they're going to score against Boston, even with Marcus Smart, who would have started on Bojan Bogdanović, the Pacers' best offensive player now, even with him out with the oblique thing, I just don't know how Indiana will score. And one of the reasons is they get a lot of points off of turnovers. Their offense, if you break it down by how a possession starts, is actually way below average after a defensive rebound and after a made basket, and very, very good after a turnover. And Boston had the third lowest turnover rate in the league and has a very good half-court defense. So, Coach, talk me into it. How are the Pacers going to score enough points to compete here?
Oh, I don't think I'll be able to talk you into that unless Boston doesn't play their A game, and I do think that's possible regarding Marcus Smart. Before I get to Boston, Indiana should really feature Sabonis. I'm going to write about that a little bit for Troop tomorrow. He's terrific and underrated, and I think you value him a lot. I know Indiana does. I think he can score in a lot of different ways for Indiana against Boston, against pretty much anyone they have. But they've got to do it. They've got to feature him. And if they don't find a matchup that can work for them, it doesn't have to be the player. It has to be the action and the player. Then they really don't have a fulcrum to kind of wheel around, you know? They've got to have that one thing that seems to work for them and cause Boston problems where they start scrambling around. And I think Sabonis is the answer to that. But here's what I'm looking at with Boston. You've mentioned mindset a few times. So let's say you're Boston and you just lost your energy, your glue, your heart and soul, not just your best defender, but your biggest will. Horford's probably the most valuable player. Kyrie's their best player, without question. Smart has, and you know this very well being up there, he's just got something that really factors in, and not having him for two series, which is what they're saying now, and they know better than we do, I don't know how much they believe they can get through the next two rounds. And that is where I worry, Zach, is to me, belief is the most important thing, right? As they said in Shawshank, hope is such an important thing. I don't know how much they hope. Last year they rallied up and it was incredible, but it was a different thing. This year, with the struggles they've had, to suddenly lose Smart, I just don't know if they believe they're going to get through. Indiana, yes. Milwaukee, I'm not sure. And then remember this. Indiana treats every possession like it's a boxing match, especially defensively. They guard you so hard. And I still think Boston's a superior team. But to go through that slog without Marcus Smart, knowing they've got Milwaukee next, I just don't think we're going to see Boston's A game, which is why I think this series will be competitive.
You know, I love Marcus Smart. I had him first team all defense. He shot it well from three this year. Everything you just said about him inspiring his teammates and lifting them and have these plays that you cannot quantify their impact. He makes them. If you have Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, Gordon Hayward playing well, and Terry Rozier who can play the two, I just think you have enough wing power, even against the Bucks, because we don't know if Brogdon is going to be able to play that series yet. Right. So I'm not sort of buying Marcus Smart as like a catastrophic loss, because I think you can plug Jaylen Brown into the starting lineup. He'll defend Bogdanović fine. I love Bogdanović. Went to his restaurant in Croatia. Big fan. He was on my list of like maybe he deserves some consideration for all NBA 13 forward, but not really. Good player. He is not like if you're game planning a team and you're like, well, okay, we're gonna spend the bulk of this for talking about Bojan Bogdanović. That team is not a good offensive team. I don't think, you know, their size and physicality, Thad Young and Miles Turner and Sabonis, like Horford and Baines, they're, you know, Sabonis will have some stray possessions where he finds Marcus Morris on him and stuff, but I just don't see a lot of sort of easily exploitable things, for them on offense. And on the other end, you know, Boston's not a great offensive team, but, Darren Collison's defense worries me in this series against Kyrie. And if Kyrie gets rolling and they start throwing the ball around, getting everyone touches and everyone starts to feel it, things can get ugly. So I think they need good point guard defense from Darren Collison. They will get it from Corey Joseph, but he's been in a hellacious shooting slump for a long time now. They will need him to make shots. And Boston scored in winning 3 out of 4. 118 points per 100 possessions. Now, if you look at their shot quality, they outshot their expected points.
Right.
But they're a good team, but it's going to come down to the other end for me. And it sounds like I'm more pessimistic than you that the Pacers could really make this a series. But we'll see.
Well, it's just, I mean, how do we know with what Boston we're going to see? On paper, I agree with you, and I definitely agree with you on guarding Marcus Smart. Again, on paper, it's the mindset that worries me. Boston has a lineup of Kyrie and Hayward and Tatum, Marcus Morris and Horford that is like a death lineup in terms of numbers. They just haven't played it very much. It was like plus 41 per 100 possessions and not that many possessions, maybe 100 possessions total. So it's like one game. So it doesn't have value yet, but it's intriguing. They've got to find something that can work. Not if they have to struggle to beat Boston and Indiana in seven, I worry about them very much going forward. But if they can put away Indiana in five or so, which is certainly possible because Indiana can really struggle to score, it'd be great if they could find a lineup that they can really hang their hat on and games with or end the second or fourth quarters with, and that might be one of them. I want to see – so one interesting thing is going to be see Boston, how they're going to not guard Thaddeus and Miles Turner. And every time I watch Indiana play, I think, oh, Miles Turner should shoot the ball. Oh, he should shoot the ball. Oh, he should shoot the ball. And a couple of times, he's agreed. He's had some games where he's taken, I think, 11 threes. He needs to do that every series because you ask the right question. How are they going to score? Well, if they're going to score consistently, they've got to be green-lighted, those guys. If Thaddeus won't do it, Miles Turner does it on occasion. He needs to do it every time, or they're really going to struggle to break 95.
Well, you see every team do it now, and we're going to see Boston do it. They'll put their center, Baines, on Thaddeus Young, and they'll put their Horford is nominally the power forward next to Baines. They'll put him on Turner because he's faster and he can get out to that 3-point shot, and that's going to create a cross match on the other end because they want Turner on Baines to have him around the rim. So, you know, which of Horford and Turner can shake loose for open threes and hit enough of them is going to be a bellwether, but, we'll see. I'm not that interested in this series, so let's move on to series number 6 as we're reaching the end here. You ready, Coach?
Yes, sir.
All right, Coach, we're going to move on to the Philadelphia 76ers and the Brooklyn Nets. And I actually think this is, for our sixth most interesting series, I think this is quite interesting. Starting with, we don't know really the status of Joel Embiid, who has been held out of a bunch of games with knee soreness, and then there was some, a little bit of different messaging from Elton Brand and then Brett Brown on the last day of the season about whether Embiid would be ready for game one. And Philly's biggest advantage in this series, obviously, is star talent, but particularly the Nets just don't really have people who can physically match up with Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid. And I think the number one thing you have to do to beat Philly is just not get mowed over by those guys. And Joel Embiid mowed over the Nets, mowed over Jared Allen, 30 points per game on 60% shooting in the regular season. Jared Allen has no chance to guard him in the post. They even tried Rondae Hollis-Jefferson on him in the last game to sort of just junk it up. Let's put five, you know, non-centers, play no center, maybe front and scramble and this and that. And Simmons, like, you could, you know, Rodion's Kurutz, Damari Carroll 3 years ago, I think, would have been one of the guys that can withstand a Simmons transition rush. I don't think he is anymore. So Philly's physical advantages. Now, the Nets have some stylistic and schematic advantages we can talk about, but Philly's smash you in the face guys are smash you in the face guys against the Nets. And then you double down with the Embiid-Redick dribble handoff game on the left side of the floor. The way Jared Allen plays, where he just doesn't guard people and he sits near the rim, I mean, if Joel Embiid sets a solid screen for J.J. Redick, it's over. He's going to hit threes all game long. So that Embiid's health is like, if he's healthy, they have a lot of built-in places to go. And if he's not healthy, then I just kind of don't know what to say anymore.
Well, I'll add something to it, just to enhance what you're saying. Almost everything I wrote starts with Embiid. He's the difference maker. Ben Simmons is going to be a great player, but he's not there yet for reasons that you know well, and I think every listener that watches the NBA knows, because he's still limited with his shooting.
By the way, interesting series for him. They used him as the primary defender on D'Angelo Russell quite a bit, and I think the sort of with this new Philly team that we've barely seen. The who guards the opposing point guard and who does the opposing point guard defend, point guard defend when Philly has the ball? Those are sort of the fundamental starting points for thinking about the Sixers, and who defended D'Angelo Russell was a lot Ben Simmons in the last couple of games they played, which is interesting.
Yeah, and he's capable of being an elite defender in any of those situations, but Embiid is the difference maker. I think if Embiid was just an average player, this would be a very, very – I think the teams are even, basically. I think they're more even than anyone realizes, with that exception. He's just that much better. You make a point of the side dribble handoff with J.J. It's the same thing on both ends because Joel doesn't want to leave the paint, and Joe Harris can really shoot. And so the handoffs with Harris can be the same kind of thing. We're going to see a lot of side dribble handoff 18-foot shots to three-pointers. The difference is the Nets don't have much else besides Russell, whereas the Sixers have Simmons in transition and Embiid. And I don't know. I think we're going to see the Nets constantly challenge Embiid because he doesn't want to leave the paint. And on the other end of the floor, if Philly is trending where they need to, they're gonna really mix up how they use Joel, because if they just let him play at the top of the key, which is amazing, then they're letting Brooklyn off the hook. I don't like when announcers, and I know you hear this, they always feel like every time Embiid shoots the ball, he's settling. Well, you get 3 points when you make those shots. And because he's such a great passer, similar to how Jokic plays, when you can run your offense that spread with the other team's big guarding at 25 feet, guys get wide open. But if you only do that, then you don't take advantage of his ability to play bully ball inside. So I like to see Embiid move around a lot offensively, and he needs to be healthy for that. That's why we're not really sure what to say if he's not.
Yeah, it's also, you know, part of the physicality thing is that the Nets are a smallish kind of team compared. I mean, Philly's a huge team, obviously.
Yeah,
you know, JJ's the smallest guy on the floor. They have Tobias, they have Butler, Simmons, three guys who are, you know, just big and strong and can post. And the Nets can actually, you know, they have Russell and Harris and, you know, depending on who they start as at the three, you know, whether it's Carroll and Kurutz, or they can get a little smaller and put, LeVert in and the lineup with Russell, Dinwiddie and LeVert has been awful, but it's a way to, like, the speed versus size thing. The Nets have the speed edge and they have a little bit of a playmaking edge. And we've seen, since Philly sort of dispensed with the entire idea of a point guard or a point guard sized defensive player, we've seen these playmaking little guys, not so little, you know what I mean, playmaking point guard types really light them up, including Russell and including especially Dinwiddie in a few games. I think the Nets are, like you said, they're going to go at Embiid. If you're going to drop back and give D'Angelo Russell floaters, he's going to take them, and then he's going to take some other stuff that's a little more valuable than floaters. I think the Nets have some interesting cards to play in how many playmakers can we get on the floor at one time? How much can we sort of ping the ball around and just get ahead of this defense? And what cost are we going to pay on the other end? And really, if the cost is Tobias Harris and Jimmy Butler are going to post up a lot, I think they're happy to pay that cost.
Yes.
The Embiid cost is the one that is too expensive, and they cannot pay it because he will put Jared Allen's afro in the basket and shoot 15 free throws every game. And they'll just have – what they've done is just they'll just have to double-team him, which they've done. And Embiid is a good passer but a turnover-prone passer, and I think that will also be tested in this series. I think the Nets have some – they got some stuff to hang their hat on, but if Embiid is healthy, I'm not sure it's going to matter.
Well, that's what it boils down to, is just how active he can be. I'll say this. We've talked about a few teams that have to win the first two at home. I've always been a huge fan of Brooklyn. I once told my wife, and she agreed, that I never wanted to work in an NBA job, and I still don't, but if I ever considered it, it would be just in one place, and that would be in Brooklyn. I think that's the coolest place to I think it's the sexiest, coolest sports franchise we have in America.
Wow.
And if they go back to Brooklyn 1-1, that place, will you tell me, how incredible is that crowd going to be? And I've been at games where the crowd, I almost feel like, really were the six men. I don't think that's always the case in the NBA for lots of reasons, in part mostly because these players are professional basketball players, and they've dealt with this before for a long time. I just can't – I think that crowd will be – it'll be great if they're down 2-0, but if they're at 1-1, I think you're going to see an incredible crowd reaction to stuff. And so Philly's got to play well, and that's why Embiid's health is so key. Boban is not someone we can't just ignore him, no pun intended. They have some options when he's in the game, but it's just not the same. And I do think that they're going to – I think if you're the Nets, you're thinking about trying to get if a player in the NBA, Zach, has a hurt hand, it seems like people keep hammering his hand. It's the same thing with a big guy that supposedly has got a bad wheel. You've got to make a move. So they're going to attack him all the time and see if he's not sore to begin with, see if they can't get him sore. But if he's able to just be 95% or so, how you put it is right. They're not going to be able to score enough going after him to make up for what he can do in terms of his production and efficiency on the other end.
I hate to break it to you, Coach, but the best Brooklyn crowds so far have been like for Dwayne Wade's last game. We haven't seen, but it's new. I do think there is going to be a lot of Philly fans at the game, so there'll be that effect as well. A lot of Sixers fans, but it's hard to talk about this series without knowing Joel's health. But one last interesting contrast in styles: the Nets, to my point about playmaking point guards, they are number four in the league in most picks, most on-ball picks, most pick and rolls basically, versus the team that does not set any on-ball picks, the 30th best team, the 30th, not best, but most frequent team. So it's a little contrast in styles, but we're going to leave that, and we are going to go on to our next series, and we have quite intentionally, in my personal interest rankings, left the 1-8 series for last. So let's stay in the East and do Milwaukee versus the limping Detroit Pistons. Welp, the Detroit Pistons, they rallied against Memphis at home and then beat the Knicks, who I didn't even look at the box score to bother looking at who the Knicks played in the season finale, but they have not exactly been playing their best heading into this 1-8 series. And obviously Blake Griffin's knee is in something is not right because they've held him out of games that were important. Milwaukee swept this series 4-0. Outscored Detroit by 20 points per 100 possessions. I just don't see any reason why this should be even remotely competitive. The Pistons do not have this sort of shooting center unless we see not a lot, like Thon Maker somehow play 20 minutes at center, which won't happen with Andre Drummond. They don't have the kind of stretch center that can punish Brook Lopez for hanging out in the paint. They don't have anyone. Blake Griffin is their best and really only matchup against Giannis. Ironically, Stanley Johnson would have been a good physical matchup for Giannis and is someone that they have guarded him with. They don't have any wings that can touch him defensively. It's not even close. I'm having a hard time, Coach. I'm really having a hard time. Can you give me something?
No, so is Detroit. No, so if you're Detroit, well, first of all, let's just say this. You always want to say something nice about a playoff team. Going into the season, I called them on some show I did. I thought they were a dark horse team. I did not think they'd just be an eight seed. They actually disappointed me. I thought they'd be better than that. I thought Dwayne would do a great job of kind of rallying the guys up. They're short of talent still, and Reggie Jackson has played better until recently anyway, but had a bad start.
Yeah, they've had a nice season. I don't mean to pick on them. They've had a nice season. Yeah. This is just a really, really terrible matchup for every team, but for particularly Detroit.
Right. Well, there's no question about it. I love Andre Drummond. The problem is this. Blake Griffin, for them to be competitive in a series, and I think they could be competitive in some of these series, but Blake has to have some kind of significant advantage against the guy guarding him, and he doesn't. Like, he's not good against Giannis. That is just a nightmare for Detroit. And I'm sure, at least I would hope, Detroit right now is spending time trying to come up with some things that they can do to get Blake going. Let's assume he's healthy. If he's not, it doesn't even matter anyway. I'm not sure it matters if he is healthy. Giannis just eats him up alive. He's just too long and athletic and strong, which is something Blake likes to bully people. He can't bully Giannis too much.
He can't bully him, and Giannis is fast enough to get out on his pick-and-pop three, which has become a weapon for him, his step-back three. Whatever three, he can get out to it. Giannis has really hurt him, actually, as a cutter. If you watch the film, he's really caught Blake kind of ball-watching and cut in for dunks along the baseline. It's just, look, saying Giannis is a bad matchup, Giannis is a bad matchup for the world, but he's, like, doubly bad against this team. And everything Andre Drummond does, score at the rim, best offensive rebounder in the league, Detroit's a great offensive rebounding team, I just don't see how that's going to work against Milwaukee, which I think was one or two in defensive rebounding, and Brook Lopez is huge. And whatever matchup advantages Detroit usually brings to the table with those two big guys are just vaporized here.
They don't matter, and in part because one of their big guys actually plays a lot like a guard, because Blake just bullies you from the perimeter. The other thing is, I was just going to say, it'd be different if you had maybe your best player being a point guard. At least that match will be different. But then you have Eric Bledsoe, who's one of my favorite players in the league, and I think he's playing his best basketball. I'm writing about him actually for tomorrow as well. I don't know if he's going to be on. I don't think you've done your All-NBA team yet, I've heard, but I'm sure he's in the running for All-Defense for your stuff.
First team All-Defense for me.
Yeah, he's got to be. He's terrific, and I really love the way he's playing. And so when I watch the series, and I'm going to watch it because I want to project out a little bit, I wrote down for both this series and the next one we'll talk about a drama-free first round. These teams are lucky enough, although the Warriors have a tougher test, to just be much better in the team they're playing. And they need to get through drama-free, because drama's coming. Like, suspense is coming. Talent is coming to try to beat them. This is not going to be the case with Detroit. Milwaukee just needs to roll through. I wish Brogdon was back. I don't know if he'll be back even for the next round. He obviously is an important player for them, but it won't matter in this one. It'd be good for them to get a series under their belt, because they haven't done that in a long time. To get a win and then get ready for what probably is going to be Boston.
I will say, it's impressed me all year, dating back to when I did a big profile of Chris Middleton, and I talked to people who were with him. He has this youth camp in Charleston, where he's from.
Yeah.
And I talked to people who go to that camp with him, and they say, you know, little kids would come up to him. These are campers, whatever, 11, 12 years old, you know, in awe of an NBA player, and say, hey, you know, man, we hope you make the All-Star team. You want to make the All-Star team, or blah, 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 you know, and all these big goals. And Chris would say, no cameras there. Not knowing any reporters are going to ask about these conversations, would say, hey, man, I just want to win a series. Like, I just want to win one series. And I think that mentality has spread through the whole team, where they don't think of themselves as proven. They don't think of themselves as entitled to one game against Detroit. And I think that's a really – and that's from Bud to Giannis, and Giannis sets the tone for everything. Giannis is well aware he hasn't won a playoff series. Now, he's played well in the playoffs, but he hasn't won one. Middleton said he stewed all summer about, and this is not, I just didn't even make my story. This is just us shooting the breeze before a game.
Yeah.
He just kept thinking about, I wish we had home court against Boston in game 7. I kept thinking back to all the regular season games we blew to not have home court, and it's just making me so mad. Like, I know that I'm not really anything in this league until I have playoff success. It's just eating at them. And even without Brogdon, and even without maybe Mirotić, although they're saying, I think the latest was he might be ready right off the bat, I think they are going to come out with an absolute killer mentality and blow the doors off the Pistons. I just think it's going to be, they are not going to warm up for round two. They are going to come out and say, it's the playoffs. Let's go. The last thing I'll say is, I want to see this happen from both strategic and entertainment perspectives. If Blake is healthy, I'd like to see them invert the matchups and have Drummond guard Giannis and Blake guard Brooke Lopez, who's just going to sit out there and pop for threes. Like, we've seen a lot of teams do that, have their centers guard Giannis.
Yeah.
Detroit has been unwilling or reluctant to do that because maybe Andre, he's got quick feet and quick hands, actually. I don't know if they just don't like it. I think it would just be fun. Just give me something fun, that's all.
Well, Giannis shooting a three is a big deal. I wrote that on my notes. I don't think he needs to shoot the three in this series. I think he needs to make threes, though, now in order to take them going forward. Teams are going to build walls around the rim and will be capable of doing it and guarding the perimeter better than Detroit. I realize they have Drummond, but he's not the best shot blocker either. He's good. He's a good rim protector. He's not Rudy Gobert. Giannis is going to have to make some threes if they want to even win the East. He's probably going to have to make some threes, and he's got to take them. He's not willing to take them. He's not going to make them. And so this is a great series where they're going to be up double digits a lot, Zach, and so that should give them the confidence to shoot it. I'll leave you with this. I really love the point you made about Middleton and that all these guys know they haven't won a series. That is in their DNA. I've got a kid that I'm working out for the draft. I don't do that often, but I've got a really talented kid who I think plays like Chris Middleton. He's a 6'9", 7'2", wingspan wing, basically. They used to be a fat guy. Now he's a 6'9", 222 guy. And when I tell people he plays like Chris Middleton, I have to laugh. Because just 2 years ago, I never would have said that, even though I liked Chris Middleton. He wasn't that guy. And Zach, he knows it. Like, Middleton is aware. Giannis was the number 15 pick. Like, these guys know. Brooke Lopez was almost a joke in some places. He shouldn't have been. But they know it's in their DNA that they have been overlooked in their careers individually, not just collectively. And so I think what you said is exactly right. I think they're coming in and they're thinking about practice only and then game one only. And then hopefully they'll continue to stay humble and get through it fast because they don't yet value the importance of rest between series. But they do value the fact that they've been slighted for a long time in their careers, and I think they're ready to rain fire from above.
Yeah, I think it's going to be ugly for the Pistons. But you know what can one do? But by the way, don't you have a new email training service that's going to be debuting on True Hoop? Correct. Speaking of, you just jogged my memory because you're working out this guy for the draft. Isn't there something you're doing?
No, the kid for the draft, Robert Franks, is just a talented kid. I used to do a lot of draft stuff. I try to see my kid a little bit more, but now that they're pretty much going to college, I have the time to work out kids, and some agents send players to me. But the draft, the training stuff, yeah, we're doing. Thank you for asking. If you go to theprotrainingcenter.com or even just go to me on Twitter, and I'll direct you at the Pro Training Center on Instagram. We're offering basically 5 workouts a week for anyone in the world. I've got players I train all over the world. As long as they can speak and read English, we're basically sending them workouts to do every day with video. So you'll know exactly what to do, and then we're letting you send video to us of you doing those drills so we can evaluate you, kind of what I've been doing for pros since Udonis was a rookie, as when I started my pro business with NBA guys 16 years ago as of last night. So, we're launching that May 1st. If you want to get better at basketball, want to get in better shape, we're going to help you do that.
Maybe I should do that, Coach. You make me a player. Make me bet more than a chucker. Might teach me some grit so I can go in and get a rebound.
You'll be in better shape. We've got some guys that are doing it now that used to play, and they just don't. They think playing 5-on-5 gets them in shape. It's mostly a bunch of jogging when you're past 25. Our stuff's a little more intense. The pace is good, and we found our players who train with us lose weight fast. Even the great athletes do.
We have one series left. I am not embarrassed to say, that I took no notes on this series because I just ran out of time because there was only one. Normally there's like 3 I can get done on Tuesday or Wednesday. This was not the case this year. Clippers, Warriors, the Clippers have been wonderful story, wonderful season, tough as all hell. The bench unit with Lou and Montrez has been an absolute delight. Well coached, Gallinari revived his career. It's been wonderful to see. They are starting Landry Shamet, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, Patrick Beverley, Danilo Gallinari, and Ivica Zubac against the Golden State Warriors. And I just see nothing but pain. I see 3 little people, one of whom is going to have to guard Kevin Durant a lot. Now you can obviously have Gallinari guard Kevin Durant and have one of the other guys guard Draymond Green. We will see some of that. I don't think it matters. I just can't see any scenario other than Stephen Curry's ankle injury is extremely serious, and Draymond Green and Kevin Durant get into a fight in the middle of the game, and Klay Thompson's dog has some issues. Maybe the dog has an allergic reaction to something. Rocco, I would never wish anything like that on Rocco. I just don't see any way that this is even remotely entertaining.
Well, the entertaining, not competitive. That is what you meant. These games will be competitive going into middle of the third quarter. I mean, these are.
I hope so. That'd be great. I'll sign up for that. I'll stop this podcast right now. I'll sign up for that. End of discussion.
Yeah, I think they will, especially early on. I think that these games through a half or so, at least two of the four games will be mildly competitive going to the middle, late third. I still think there might be at least one game that's competitive in the fourth. Golden State's had found their rhythm again. They had played really well when DeMarcus first was in the starting lineup, and then after the All-Star break, they quit. They just stopped playing. And so if you look at their advanced metrics over the course of the season, they're down a little bit. But that bad stretch is in there, and I wrote about this a couple weeks ago on True Hoop. They're back to playing great. The starting five has figured out more and more how to play. DeMarcus, we'll see. We'll see how he does. Actually, in my newsletter tomorrow, I pretend to be Steve Kerr as to what he says to these guys before game one because, I mean, as you put it, the Clippers are starting two rookies and three little dudes. Patrick Beverley doesn't know he's little, by the way.
Oh, Patrick Beverley. Look, I don't want to even call. I hope that I'm afraid of Patrick Beverley. I like Patrick. We've talked. He's a nice guy. He's come on the jump. I hope he never hears that because he'll come at me and say, I'm little? Okay.
Yeah, I heard a story. I don't remember who told me now, but a player from his area told me he's the one guy. He's a Rutgers area, Chicago. He's like the one guy that nobody there will mess with. This was like 5 years ago. This guy told me this. He's amazing, but he is indeed small, and he'll fight like crazy. And they will. I actually think if the Warriors, let's say we talk in 3 months, I see you in Vegas this summer or whatever, and the Warriors have won a championship. I'm probably going to say, you know what, playing the Clippers was the best thing for him, because that's a team it's not about talent, it's about fight. And we're gonna see how Golden State handles their emotional IQ, and it's specifically DeMarcus. I think DeMarcus needs to handle himself like a true role player. I think he's capable of doing that, and he's better than a role player. But if he just lets his stars control things and does his job, no one gets any technicals. They try to get through this in four games, maybe five, but probably four. They're going to be much better suited going forward. If the drama starts creeping in now, they lost to Cleveland that one series years ago. It was mostly Curry's ankle, but they also were drained, emotionally drained, like we've seen Harden get a couple of times. They've got to avoid that. It's going to be a grind, and whoever, they play Houston maybe second round, right, if Houston gets through Utah.
Yeah,
so
yeah, but again, Denver, the basketball gods, I will finish by saying this, the basketball gods are coming for Denver, because I'm sort of like three quarters joking. I don't blame Denver for seeing an opportunity to manipulate the schedule, manipulate the results and manipulate the seeding. And it all came together for them. The basketball gods have smiled on them. Somewhere there is going to be a price to pay because the basketball gods cannot allow this, to go unchecked. And I don't know what it's going to be. I don't know if I just don't know what it's going to be. I don't know, but the basketball gods are coming for them. And by the way, just as many people have said, it's just nonsense that they're able to do this. We should just let the top two seeds or whatever pick their first round opponents or pick their opponents all the way through or something like that. Because the fact that the last 10 days of the NBA season turns into the analytics department of every team game theorying out, okay, if we lose this game to that team and that team loses that game to that team, and then we win that game and that team's going to sit all their guys because they're not going to care. And Mario Hezonja is going to play point guard for that team because the last 10 days of the season are a joke. We can get the second seed. It's just, these games are unwatchable but the basketball gods are coming somewhere. They exist and they're coming, and they're different than the lottery gods, by the way. The lottery gods are a different set of gods. So they're coming for Denver. Okay. So that's it, coach. I don't want to talk about Warriors Clippers anymore. This is always a pleasure. I will make my predictions on the big ESPN page where you see all of our little faces or all of our names or whatever logo teams we picked. So my picks will be coming, but everybody likes this podcast when you come on, coach, and you make us all smarter, and it's good to hear your voice. Good to talk to you.
I appreciate the opportunity, Zach. Enjoy the postseason. I'm sure we'll be in touch.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.